Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. If you enjoy the teachings from Beth Emmanuel, do us a favor and share the links with your friends. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends about the things you are learning at Beth Emmanuel. Help us grow the message.
It's Yohanan chapter 2, verse 11, where it says, "This was the first of the signs that Yeshua did in Cana, which is in the land of the Galilee. He revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him." Here's the idea. This is the first of the signs. What's the second? Or the third, or the fourth? Why does it call this out as the first of the signs, as if it's anticipating that there should be a list of signs that are, where are we going to get the rest of this? You know, we know that the master does a lot of miracles, but this seems to imply that it's something more than just a miraculous deed. This is a sign. A sign is something that signifies something, right? Something else. It signifies something else. It's not just a miraculous event, although a miraculous event could signify something. Anyway, so what makes this the first sign, and where's the rest of the signs? Actually, there's a theory about the composition of the Gospel of John. You'll need a DHE. You want to just grab one of those Bibles there. Grab one for Eric, too. Oh, okay. There's a theory about the composition of the Gospels, of the Gospel of John, that one of the source texts that went into the creation of the Gospel of John is called a signs gospel. Now, what would a signs gospel be? This would just be a list. This would be a list of the significant miraculous signs that Yeshua of Nazareth performed that persuaded his followers, this guy is the Messiah. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about a list of signs. It persuades Yeshua's followers that he must be the Messiah. How do we know he's the Messiah? Because remember this, and this. All these signs signify he must be the Messiah. All right. So my suggestion, I made up the list, okay? I made up the list of what I thought seven was a good number. And so I came up with seven signs from the Gospel of John. They all have to be from the Gospel of John, obviously, because John's the only one who's bringing this whole matter up. But seven signs from the Gospel of John that we're going to look at as this significant source list, if there really was such a thing. So I'll read you these seven signs, okay? The first sign, the water to wine at Cana, which is right where we are in the text, obviously. Okay, that one was easy. The second sign, a healing in Cana and Capernaum. It happens in both places simultaneously. It's one of the great stories of the Master. It's sort of an under-celebrated miracle. The third sign, the healing at the Pool of Bethesda. The fourth sign, the feeding of the multitude. The fifth sign, the blind man in Jerusalem, the healing of the blind man in Jerusalem. The sixth sign, the resurrection of Lazarus. And the seventh sign, of course, the resurrection of Yeshua, the resurrection of Messiah. That one has to be the big seventh, the big final seventh sign. All right, so here's my idea. What we'll do is we'll go through these seven signs, learn these seven stories, and talk about why they might be signs, why these might be the signs that prove Yeshua is who he claims to be. He is the promised Messiah. And so we'll start tonight with the first sign, the wedding at Cana. I'm going to be drawing heavily from Torah Club as we talk through this. So if you don't want to write stuff down, you can just get the notes right out of Chronicles of the Messiah, because that's the stuff I'm going to be working out of. Okay, so we'll start. Turn back a page, back to where we were, 333. I'm going to start with the text right at the top of the chapter, Yohanan chapter 2. It says, "On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana, which is in the Galil, and Yeshua's mother was there. All right. Let's talk about Cana. It's Kfar Cana. We call it Cana in English, right? I want you to turn, I know I just had you turn here, but now I want you to turn to the very back of the book. You'll find these maps, page 468 and 469. 468 is sort of a full view of the land of Israel, and 469 we get a blow up of the Galilee, where most of the action in the Gospels takes place. So, if you're looking at the map, see if you can find the Sea of Galilee, all right? That's pretty easy, right? You find the Sea of Galilee. Now, I want you to head to the west, that is, take a left in a straight line from Magdan, and you'll see Cana. There's Cana. It's a really great site. It's not really been dealt with. It's not really been excavated. I haven't had the privilege to stand on that site yet, but I've driven past it many times. My brother always points it out and says, now, if you look across the valley there, you see that little rise at the base of the hill. That's the site of Kfar Cana. And the significant thing that I want to show you on the map is just how very close it is to some other significant cities. First of all, Jotapata. You see Jotapata right above it? You know what happened at Jotapata? That's where the general of the Galilee tried to hold off the Roman legions during the Jewish revolt. And his name was Flavius Josephus. Well, it wasn't Flavius yet. It was just Josephus at the time. But that's the siege of Jotapata, where Josephus surrendered and became a prisoner of the Romans. All right, that's just interesting. You see Kokava? Kokava, which means the star, Kokava is one of the villages in which the family of the master lived into the second century. So his relatives, the Desposini, were reported as living in Kokava, the star, as in a star shall rise out of Jacob. Now, let your eyes go down to Sepphoris. Sepphoris, it's like based on the word Tzipor, Tziporet, means birdie. This is the city, the city of Sepphoris is the city where it was in the days of the master, it was a Romanized city, but since it's one of the cities that surrendered right away in the Jewish revolt, it survived the revolt, and so it became a rabbinic center in the days of the apostles. And so it's in Sepphoris that we read that story in the Talmud about Rabbi Eliezer having the conversation with Jacob or James, the disciple of Yeshua, and they have that whole conversation about the hire of a prostitute and ritual purity and that sort of thing in the upper market of Sepphoris. All right, now let your eyes drop down a little further from Sepphoris, and you will see Netzaret. That, of course, is Nazareth. So what I'm showing you is that there's a concentration of Yeshua activity in this area. This is, aside from the Josephus thing, these other cities, Kokava, Sepphoris, and Netzaret, all have strong associations with the disciples of Yeshua. Okay, that's what I needed you to see. You can leave the map now. We'll go back to the text. So the text says, on the third day there was a wedding in Cana, which is in the Galil, and Yeshua's mother was there. The significance of this is that obviously it's a relative. Well, not necessarily. Everybody knows everybody in these small villages. These little Galilean villages are very much like little Beth Emmanuels, where everybody's related and everybody knows everybody. And so if it's a wedding, you know, you should probably be there because it's your something or other who's getting married. And so that's probably what's going on here. She's there, and she seems to be in a position of some sort of responsibility for the wedding as well. At least she has some concern for how things are going off, right? Because when they run out of wine, she's worried about it. She's concerned about it. And so she's there, and the master is also there. He's attending with his disciples. Now, interesting thing, these are brand spanking new disciples who have not yet even committed to being lifelong disciples of Yeshua. Instead, these are just, he's picked these up along the way. And this is before the formal calling, you know, the formal call of leave your nets and come after me. This is when they're just getting to know him. And so he's here with his disciples, and they were among those invited to the wedding. Now, this is an interesting thing from my perspective, because there's this combination of rabbis and weddings where the sages said, the sages said that when the rabbi at the wedding, it was his obligation to bring joy to the bride and the groom and to provide some of the entertainment. So, for example, the disciples of Hillel used to sing before the bride. They'd have a song they'd sing for the bride. Rabbi Dimi reported that in the land of Israel, the sages also used to sing to the bride, and they'd sing about how pretty she was, even without makeup. She was a graceful gazelle. Rabbi Yehuda Bar Eli used to take myrtle branches and dance before the bride while singing. A beautiful, graceful bride. Rabbi Shmuel, the son of Rabbi Yitzhak, danced before the bride while juggling torches. You know, he did doing like feats of wonder and tricks, juggling torches. So to entertain the bride and make her, Rabbi Acha used to take the bride on his shoulders and dance while holding her aloft. But they said, don't do that anymore. Acha, that's gone too far. But anyway, so my point is that there's an expectation here on the rabbi to make sure that everybody's having a good time. And here's Yeshua, the young up-and-coming teacher. And so it says, when the wine ran out, the mother of Yeshua said, they have no wine. Now, wine running out at a wedding is not an uncommon situation. That's something that's pretty routine. But especially if the wedding goes for 7 days, right? So you know how we here do the Sheva Brachot, the 7 days after the wedding. We have these meals going on for the 7 days after the wedding. That's because that's in commemoration of the original custom of this celebration lasting for 7 days and 7 days of banqueting and feasting to celebrate the union of the bride and the groom. You can imagine how if there was a lot of people getting married, you know, and it's like you could have one of these every week, is what I'm saying. But anyway, so it's not unusual, it's not unexpected that they might run out of wine over the course of a long wedding week. So she says, they have no wine. And Yeshua says to her, what do I have to do with you, woman? My time has not come. Now, isn't that rude? I mean, who talks to their mom like that? What do I have to do with you, woman? You try talking to your mom like that and see how that works out for you. So you just have to say, no, mom, look over here. That's an idiom, actually. I was speaking idiomatically when I sassed off like that. If you look over here, here's a useful tool. Do you see how in the text of the Delitzsch Gospel here, there's a little tiny underscore under the W of what, where it says, what do I have to do with you, woman? Do you see that little tiny underscore under the W? That's a sign. Yeah, that's one of the seven signs. That little underscore under the W indicates that there is an idiom being employed here. And so now you can look over to the margin of the page and you'll see the idiom defined. You see this? The Hebrew idiom defined. The Hebrew says, Ma li valach, what do I have to do with you? And in English, we would say this, what do you have against me? Or why are you picking on me? Is maybe a way that we see this being used in the Bible. Why are you picking on? Why are you always picking on me? So this is more. Yeah, this sounds more like a son. A son might say to his mother. Why are you picking on me? And then he says, "Woman." That's one isn't marked with a underscore, but that's just part of the language. That's like ma'am. It sounds rude in English. It certainly is rude in English, but that wouldn't be rude in the Hebrew of the time. So just to diffuse that situation. Why are you picking on me, ma'am? My time has still not come. Now, this is a strange thing to say. My time has still not come. What does he mean? Well, there's two possibilities of what he means. On the one hand, maybe he means my time for doing miraculous things like turning water into wine hasn't yet come. But that doesn't make sense to me. Because were people expecting him to start doing miracles? Like, man, wow, what are you, like 30, 36 years old here? You should, come on, you know, get on with the miracles or something like that. It doesn't. You see what I'm saying? We might come up with that explanation because we know what's going to happen. But from the perspective of the story, that's not something Yeshua would have said. Like, pretty soon I'll start doing miracles. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. That's not. Instead, when he says, my time has not yet come, I read it as meaning the Messianic era isn't here yet. Because what is the time of Messiah? It's the Messianic era. And that makes sense in respect to the request. The request she makes, they've run out of wine. He says, my time hasn't come yet. What you need to know about the Messianic era and wine is that the two go together. There's a very strong tradition in Jewish eschatology that when the appointed hour of Messiah comes, when the Messianic era comes, the righteous are going to sit at this great banquet at the table of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and there's going to be just an abundance of wine. This comes from the prophets. This isn't just a pipe dream. It comes from the prophets. The whole idea of the banquet comes from Isaiah. The idea of the abundance of the wine in the land of Israel also comes from several places in the prophets where it speaks of how God will bless the agriculture of the land and the land will be filled with the new grain and the wine and the oil. New grain, wine, and oil. That's a summary of the agricultural year for the land of Israel. New grain, that's around Passover, Shavuot. Wine, that's in the summer when the vineyards are mature. And oil, that's in the fall when the olives are ready to drop. New grain, wine, and oil. You'll see that. Just pay attention to that. When you're reading the scriptures, you'll see that triad of agricultural bounty that's coming over and over. All right. So, I'll read you a midrash from Numbers Rabbah. It says, the Holy One, blessed be He, will make a banquet for the righteous in the Garden of Eden, and He will give them to drink wine preserved in its grapes since the 6 days of creation. Now, you know from when we do the Messiah banquet that we take out this text and talk about this every year at Passover. Talk about the wine that's preserved in the kept wine, the wine that's preserved in the grapes since the 6 days of creation. So this is something that is anticipated for the kingdom. And our master makes a reference to this when he says, I tell you, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine again until I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. So this is, he's making reference to this expectation that there will be this miraculous wine that's going to be served at the banquet in the kingdom. And not only that, but the agricultural bounty of those days will be such that a man will bring one grape on a wagon. He'll need a wheelbarrow for one grape, or a ship. That'll be the cargo on one ship will be one grape. And here's what he'll do, that I'm reading to you from the Talmud. He will put it in the corner of his house, and he will use its contents as if it was a large cask. So in other words, he'll tap that one grape and just you put a spigot on that grape, and right. And there will be no grape that does not contain 30 kegs of wine. This is what it means when it says in Deuteronomy 32:14, you drank the foaming blood of the grape. It doesn't say foaming blood of grapes. It says the foaming blood of the grape. Yeah. All right. So, okay, that's, you know, that's hyperbole and so forth. But another place that we find this prophecy is in the... I'm going to grab this text for you from Genesis 49. The blessings over Judah, which are messianic blessings. Everybody agrees that these are blessings about the kingdom and about Messiah. And it says in Genesis 49 that he will bind his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. And he has washed his garments in wine, his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. So when it says he's going to bind his donkey to the vine, you would never bind your donkey to a vine. I mean, that would be the worst thing you could do to a vine. You'd wreck the vine because the donkey is going to constantly be pulling. He's going to wreck the vine. So why would you bind your donkey to the vine? Because these vines are so sturdy and strong in the kingdom that you don't have to worry about the tether on the donkey rubbing that vine and killing that vine. It says that he'll wash his garments in wine. Why would you wash your garments in wine? It's not going to get very clean. Well, here's the point. The point is that wine is as common as laundry water in the Messianic era. You know, you just, the laundry water, you dump out the laundry water. It's like, oh, that's just wine. That's just more wine. You know, that's what it's saying. His eyes are darker than wine. That's a strange. Sometimes I think I've read this translation as his eyes are red with wine, which I know about that. Then there's this saying of the master, which comes from, this is from a non-canonical source as well. This is reported in the Apostolic Fathers, that the master used to say, "The days will come in which vines shall grow, and on every one of the clusters 10,000 grapes, and every grape when pressed will give 5 and 20 measures of wine." So again, this is just Jewish eschatology. So all of this is to say that when Mary says to her son, when Miriam says, they have no more wine, she in essence, you know, remember, she treasured this stuff up in her heart from the very beginning. She's at this point, she's the only person in the world that believes he's the Messiah. Well, no, actually these new disciples are also of that conviction. But she's been a believer for a long, long time, okay? And so she says, they have no wine, hint, hint, right? I know who you are, and So could we get a little advance on the Messianic era? She's asking for a little bit ahead of time. And he responds, he says, well, what can I do about it? You know, this isn't the Messianic era. This isn't the kingdom yet. And so what does she say after he refuses her? His mother said to the servants, do whatever he says to you. In other words, she does not accept his refusal, which this is... It's from this perspective, you see why we got the idea that if you really want something done, you know, you go to Mary, you know, because... Yeah, exactly, right. I think that's where that comes from. So she says, do whatever he says to you. 6 stone pitchers were prepared according to the ordinance of the Yehudim for their purification. All right, why stone? Well, stone is the only kind of vessel that is not subject to ritual impurity. So if you had a clay pot is subject to ritual impurity. If you had a skin, like an animal skin that you were storing a liquid in, that's subject to ritual impurity. But stone has this intrinsic value that it's not susceptible to any sort of contamination, any kind of Levitical contamination. So the advantage is that whatever you store in the stone vessels cannot be ritually defiled. Okay, and so for this reason, the archaeology of this time period, the late Second Temple period, produces an enormous amount of stoneware, which is amazing. But here's the thing about the amazing thing about these stone pots that have this water for purification. We don't really know what this means. Water for purification. Does this mean that they were using this for some sort of purification ritual, or is it just that they were trying to keep their water supply uncontaminated? I kind of think it's the latter. They were just worried about the water supply not being exposed to any ritual impurity, so there wouldn't be any issues or questions about the water. All right, here's the remarkable thing. It says, each of them was able to hold 2 or 3 batim. Isn't that amazing? That's a huge stone pot, don't you? But you're saying, wait a second, what's a bat? What are batim? So here's the real great thing. Now you see how the word batim is in italics? You see that? So that tells you, oh, this is a word that's been transliterated. This isn't an English word, it's a word that's been transliterated. So what that means is you should be able to look over in the margin, on the other side of the page, you should be able to look in the margin and see what are batim. See what that transliterated word is. And there it is. A bat is a liquid measure of about 6 gallons. Okay, so let's do the math. Each of these stone vessels could hold 2 or 3 batim, and each bat is 6 gallons, so that's 12 to 18 gallons.
Wow.
Okay, so I have this situation at my house where the plumbing is really old St. Paul, and so it's all, you know, it's like it's lead plumbing from the street into the house, okay? So we can't drink the water in my house. It's never been able to without digging up the front yard and replacing all the plumbing and so forth. So what we do is we have a water filter, of course, but a water filter doesn't keep up with us. So I generally have to get these 5-gallon jugs and schlep them to the grocery store and back and fill it up at the grocery store. And you know, this happens pretty much every week. I got these 5-gallon jugs. And this is why, because I'm always carrying these 5-gallon jugs around, right? I'm thinking 12 to 18 gallons, right? That's a huge, enormous. It wasn't just one of them. And it wasn't just one of them. There's actually 6 of them. It's a great abundance. A great abundance. And I'm certain that in John, that nothing is accidental in John. If he mentions a detail, there's a significance to it. And so if he says that there were 6 stone pitchers, there has to be something that he thinks we should think of when we hear 6 stone pitchers. The 6 stone pitchers. Obviously, that's an allusion to the 6 orders of the Mishnah, or something like that. Something like that, but probably not that. Not that, but something like that, okay? But we don't know what it is. And that's the way it is with a lot of these cryptic allusions. Going on with the story, Yeshua said to them, fill the pitchers with water. They filled them to the top. That sounds to me, when I hear that, the prophet says, do it, they do it. This reminds me of the stories of Elisha and Elijah. Fill the pitchers with the water. They filled it to the top. He said, now draw some and take it to the master of the banquet. They took it. Anyway, so yeah, the Kos HaBesora, the cup of the good news. Or if you prefer to make it more obvious, the cup of the gospel. It's declaring the good news of the wedding, of the matrimony, the match that has just been made. That's the name of it. He brings it to the head waiter, the leader of the banquet, tasted the water, which had turned into wine, not knowing where it was from. But the servers who had drawn the water knew. I just always picture those guys snickering, you know, like, he's drinking water. The leader of the banquet called to the groom and said to him, everyone gives out the good wine first, and after they have drunk to overflowing, he gives them the bad. But you have hidden the good wine until now. You put out the good wine first. Why? Because with the beginning, the first cups of wine, you can still taste things, right? But you're just like everything else, you drink a little bit of wine, you know, you kind of get a numbing effect, anesthesia effect of alcohol begins to, and then you can like pass off the bad wine, you know, then you take out the bad wine and nobody notices after they've had a couple cups of the good wine. And so he says, that's what everybody does. It's a universal custom that you put out the good wine first. It's a universal custom. Everybody does that. But you saved the best for last. You saved the good wine for now. You have hidden the good wine until now. There's a remarkable parallel to this, actually, in the Talmud as well. This is from Tractate Brachot. Come in here. If one has already said a blessing over wine, he doesn't need to make a blessing over a change to a superior vintage of wine that is later served at the same meal. He doesn't need to. He's already said a blessing for wine. You don't have to say the blessing for wine every time you have open a new bottle, you know. But Rabbi Yosef Bar Abba said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, although they said that he doesn't need to make the blessing again over a change to a superior vintage of wine, he should still say, blessed is he who is good and who does good. Here we have just such an occasion for this blessing to be uttered. And verse 11 says, this was the first of the signs that Yeshua did in Cana, which is in the land of the Galil. He revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. What does it mean, he revealed his glory? I guess what you could say is when it says he revealed his glory, it means he manifested or made obvious his importance, his stature, his person. It's a revelation of something that wasn't immediately obvious about someone's stature or some, in this case, his messiahship. Yes. So the disciples and the guests present at the wedding see this miracle. And they interpret this miracle the same way that Miriam, the mother of the master, is interpreting the miracle. And she's the one who asked for the miracle as evidence of the Messianic era being at hand. That the kingdom must be so close that this guy can just reach right across and draw, you know, wine out of the abundance of the wine that's in the kingdom. He can just reach right across and bring this. And so this corresponds also to how he taught us to pray. When he said, he taught us to pray, give us this day the bread of tomorrow. So new grain, wine, and oil. The bread is the new grain of tomorrow, the bread of tomorrow, the abundance of the Messianic era, the substance and the abundance of the Messianic era. That's what we're asking for. Just Miriam was just asking for the wine of tomorrow when she asked him to do something at the wedding. She said, give us some of the wine of tomorrow. They interpret this as a sign pointing toward the Messianic era when wine will flow in abundance. And in that day, Messiah himself is going to be the toastmaster, the master of the banquet at the wedding banquet, and he will preside over the wedding supper of the Lamb, it's called in the book of Revelation. You ever notice all these different parables that Yeshua says, to what shall I compare the kingdom? And it very often goes in the direction of some sort of wedding imagery or some sort of wedding symbolism. It's like a great banquet, like a king had a son who was getting married. It's like a man who attended a banquet. It's like 10 virgins on who the retinue of the bride on her wedding day. These kind of parables all invoking this wedding celebration imagery.
By the way, you do the math on the size of those jars according to the way we usually measure amount of wine in terms of bottles.
Right.
It'd be about 500 bottles or about 40 cases of wine.
Oh, my.
Okay. So this is, but it speaks to the abundance. 40 cases of wine. Yeah, 500 bottles. It speaks to the abundance of the Messianic era. It's exactly what we would anticipate. It's exactly what we should expect from Messiah. And now you understand the significance of why it says this was the first of the signs that he performed. So my expectation, since this sign conforms so precisely to Jewish expectation of the kingdom and of Messiah, then what I would expect for the rest of the signs is that we should be able to find similar correspondences to somehow each sign is going to teach us something about the kingdom, is going to represent the kingdom for us in some way.
Thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's virtual community and support our efforts for the kingdom by clicking on the support tab at BethEmmanuel.org.